Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, fortnightly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And this week, we're very pleased to have on us Carson Gross, who is author of the very, very, very super exciting HTMX library. Hello, Carson. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you. Very excited to be here. Very excited to see the Django community taking a look at HTMX.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been a real revelation. So for the audience, let's go back a bit. And can you give us sort of your backstory, and then we'll get into the backstory of HTMX and what it is and what, you know, why we're all so excited.
Sure. So I have to admit, I've never done any serious Python development, at least not in Angular. But I've been programming for a very long time. I programmed in Java just forever. And I started doing web application development back in the late 90s, just right when things were starting to get going. And always kind of was in the Java world until probably around 2005, and then I started picking up Rails and started doing a lot of Rails development. I still work on Rails in there's a startup that I work for. Well, it's not a startup anymore, but a software company that I founded with a couple of other people that's based on Rails. And so the original library that turned into HTMX was called Intercooler.js, and I built it sort of in the Rails with a Rails backend, against a Rails backend.
I've heard you say that you built Intercooler because you hate JavaScript, but Now you're an expert in JavaScript because You're bearing the burden for the rest of us. Does that hold?
There's the irony of me not wanting to write any JavaScript is that I've had to write an awful lot of JavaScript to do so. And I write in a very idiosyncratic way. I tend to write in the older ES6, I think it's called, form. And I don't use the newer stuff. HTMX is IE11 compatible. My understanding is that IE11 is being formally destroyed here in a few months, but I've always coded, and I found a way that I like to where I can write JavaScript without creating too many bugs. It's a very functional way, but it's very idiosyncratic. So when normal, you know, quote unquote normal JavaScript developers come and look at my code base, they are often very confused. I have found that other people coming from outside the JavaScript community find it fairly approachable, but it's definitely not the standard way to write JavaScript.
Can I ask you about Intercooler then? Because if you were using Rails, perhaps we need to fill in some context for people who don't know about HTMX. So let's talk about briefly what HTMX is, and then we'll cut back to the history.
Yeah. So HTMX, a good way to think of it, a good way to start in on it is, when you've got a normal web app with anchors and forms, right? We're just writing a normal vanilla web app. The problem that you run into from an interactive standpoint is that every time you click on a link or submit a form, you're going to do a full page refresh. And so you get that clunky, full screen re-render. And so one step into the mindset of HTMX and Intercooler was, well, why don't we make it so that those can replace a part of the screen rather than having to replace the entire screen? So that's a step towards that, and thinking about, okay, let's take the hypertext that we've got, HTML, and let's extend it so that it can do more stuff as a hypertext. And so replacing parts of the screen is one, maybe responding to other events, not just click and submit, is another way to improve the way HTML works. Maybe you don't want only anchor tags and forms to submit to make server requests, right? Very often you have other like divs or whatever that are making requests these days. And then the last kind of component in there is making all of the HTTP actions available. So it's not just get and post. Most web apps, unfortunately, are hamstrung by the defaults in HTML, where it's only easy to issue gets and posts, but there's other stuff, there's deletes, and so, you know, there's all the RESTful types of actions that you want to use. And so taking all of those and surfacing them in HTML is sort of what of what HTMX does.
Yeah, okay. And just to, as an example, a form I was working on last week, it just took on the, it was just a select box that took on the change event, and would, when it, when you triggered the change, it would go and fetch the some related data and put that straight into the page. You know, it was a couple of data attributes and a Django view on the back end just waiting there, and that was it. And it was as nice as anything, really. It was
it's just one example. Yeah, exactly. So you can have an app that has the nice features we've come to like from the more extensive front end frameworks like React, but hopefully without all that heavy weight. Without all the coding infrastructure that's necessary for that.
Literally, I didn't write any JavaScript. It was right. Just a few HTML attributes. So that was cool.
Yeah.
So let's swing back to, so with HTMX in play, so it's this cool library, and you talked about building it, working with Rails.
Yeah.
But Rails has, for my history, it was PJAX and then TurboLinx and then the Hotwired stuff. And so I found HTMX in the few weeks after the Hotwire announcement, where they had the nice website and there was a lot of hype, and someone mentioned, Adam Johnson mentioned HTMX. I was like, oh, what's this? Check that out as well.
Yeah.
It's in the same space. So how did you, how come you came to write Intercooler rather than going
just
along
using,
with the...
Yeah, just using TurboLinx would have been a little bit easier for sure. TurboLinx in particular. PJAX, I mean, I used PJAX back when that was the big option. And TurboLinx, obviously, in the Rails community is very big, and people use it outside of Rails as well. And it's a good piece of technology. But I, when I was looking at it, I felt like it just needed more. It needed more of a formalization. TurboLinx and Hotwire both kind of have a magic. They reflect. I think both libraries reflect the personalities of the people who are developing. And so DHH really likes magic. Like, he wants things to just work. And to me, when I especially as I got into it and started to figure out what I wanted Intercooler to be, I felt more like I was coming at this from the direction of, I want to improve HTML as a hypertext and not provide some total solution that is magic and everything works, you know, but it's hard to understand what's going on. So HTMX, I hope, is fairly incremental, and you build up, you know, a few attributes, and you understand what's going on. It's not just automatic.
Yeah. Okay.
So it gives you more control. And again, I think it's just a philosophical difference. I was trying to think more, let's go with the grain of HTML and take it further rather than let's just make it all work magically.
That's kind of a good answer for a Django podcast, because quite often people say, well, what's the difference between Django and Rails? And one answer to that question is that Django, you kind of do it, it's not quite so auto magic. You know, Rails gives you the full controllers and the AJAX forms and all the things just out of the box, and that's lovely. Whereas Django, you have to wire that stuff up yourself. But, you know, there's a bit more flexibility perhaps, or, you know, who knows? You know, you can...
I think also you understand the tool a little bit deeper. You have to be careful with too much magic, because you can have sort of a helpless feeling when it doesn't do what you want it to do, right?
Yeah, it's great until it doesn't work.
Right, and so, you know, there's that first week can feel real, can feel wonderful, but then later on when you need a little bit more flexibility, or you're trying to understand why something isn't working exactly the way that you want, being a little bit more explicit, I think, is often pretty useful. Especially with editors being as good as they are these days, I've kind of moved away from, you know, trying to minimize everything, and it's okay to be explicit at times. And so HTMX is definitely, it's much more explicit than some of the other options that are out there for this style of development. I should mention Livewire as well. That's another example. And in both of those cases, Hotwire is the same way in that it requires WebSockets. There's a server-side component to using it that is necessary. And HTMX does not have that explicitly. I've been trying to focus just, it's purely extending HTML. It's hypertext, and therefore it doesn't make any specific requirements on your backend. So it can be used with anything. And Django is a great example of something it can be used with.
Okay, so then I have one more sort of question from the history and the backstory side of it, is why, when there was Intercooler, is there now HTMX? What's the story there between the change in the libraries?
Right. Last summer, I had Intercooler, excuse me. I think I created it back in 2013, so it's been around for quite some time. And I came out of the jQuery world. I did a lot of jQuery development, and so Intercooler JS was based on jQuery. Used all the jQuery infrastructure. And last summer, you may recall that the world kind of shut down, and so I was sitting around and thinking, all right, what do I want to do with myself to keep from going insane? And it always bothered me that HTMX it didn't at the start, but it increasingly bothered me that Intercooler was dependent on jQuery. And JavaScript had come a long way in the last, 7 or 8 years. And so I said to myself, all right, well, let's try and see how hard it would be to break that dependency on jQuery and just write it in pure JavaScript. And along those same lines, one of the things that always had bothered me when I tried to tell people about Intercooler.js, and I have to say I've gotten quite a lot of grief on the internet when I try to talk to people about this style of development, particularly in the JavaScript communities, which is, it's understandable. The library was being compared with React.js or with whatever the big JavaScript library of the time was. Initially, it was, what was Google's?
Angular.
Angular, yes, thank you. So it was compared with Angular, it was compared, whatever. And I didn't like that .js aspect of the name, because I felt like what I was really trying to do was push HTML as a hypertext and see how much expressiveness we could get in HTML itself as a hypertext. And so I started looking around for better name, and HTMX.org was available. And I was like, well, I mean, come on, you got to take that. That's crazy. It's still available. 2020, and that obviously I did a lot of documentation rewrites and so forth, and really tried to clean the library up as well. I'm much happier with I think Intercooler is a great piece of technology. And if you're using it, don't feel like you have to move to HTMX anytime soon. But I think HTMX is a much cleaner implementation of the concept.
Okay.
Super. Can I, on the history, I'm curious. So 2013, when you first started on Intercooler, I remember, yeah. I think it was around, was it 2012 when React, so the idea of the virtual DOM came out, because that took a while for most people to wrap their heads around, but then it was pretty amazing. But then you looked at that and said, well, let's go the completely opposite way to achieve something similar. I think that's amazing.
The company that I run is called Big Sky Software, and our tagline is that we find hot new industry trends and then do the opposite of that. So I've always been a little bit of a contrarian by nature, and that's good in some ways and bad in others. It really came out of the original concept came out of a situation where I was writing some pretty hairy jQuery code to update a table dynamically. And the performance was just atrocious. And so I just almost out of desperation tried rendering it on the client side and then slamming it into the DOM, and it was instant. And so I said to myself, well, self, let's not do a bunch of front-end stuff. Let's just try and formalize this notion of, Ajax grabbing some HTML and slamming it into the DOM. And it's obviously become much more sophisticated than that this point, but it came out of that world. I feel like I'm not as smart as some of these other people, and just like I can't figure that out. I'm just gonna do it this way.
Yeah, this, you know, all great truths start off as blasphemy, so who's to say.
I mean, but is it blasphemy? I have to whisper, like, because there was this thing that I was using a long time ago, jQuery.load, right, which would get your HTML and it would replace the content of the div, and I was like, oh, this is quite good, and then I wasn't allowed to use that for a long time, but why not,
we're bringing it back. Maybe we'll talk about HyperScript too. You want to get really, really obscure.
Well, let's save that for a minute, because I wanted to ask just a more sort of abstract question, because everyone's been telling me that the modern web has to be done with, you know, isomorphic JavaScript on, you know, server, sends out the thing, it gets rehydrated back on the client and all of these things. But the performance of that and the bandwidth required for that seems to be quite high. And then but for a number of years, I felt as if I'm swimming against the current of this kind of, you just must do it this way, otherwise you can't possibly compete. And yet here we are, HTMX comes along and you know, the related libraries that are in the similar kind of domain. And it's like, no, but we can just render the HTML on the server and inject it in the DOM, and that work. I mean, what, just at that kind of theoretical level, what do you think is going on? And do you think
I think there's a sociological aspect to it too that you just have to be cognizant of, which is the industry is prone to trends. There's no doubt about that. And some, you know, we've been down some bad paths. Google, you know, everyone trusts Google. Everyone trusts Facebook. Google had quit. Angular, I think Angular 1.0 anyways, is widely agreed to have been a pretty terrible idea. So there's a lot of bad ideas that come along. We just have authority based on where they come out of. We're a forward-looking industry. We don't do a great job of taking what works and building on it incrementally. And that's, you know, I think there's some personality traits to like good developers that make that difficult. You want to be innovative. There's the whole job situation, right? Like being left behind technologically can be a fatal situation in the tech industry. And so that puts a lot of pressure on people to look for the new stuff. But when you look at, if you're able to take a step back and look at things from a little longer perspective, and I don't blame people who can't, you know, someone whose only experience with web development is React and all, like that entire infrastructure, you can't really, they don't have that longer term perspective on the way things are. The original web architecture, I don't feel like it was communicated well. REST and Hadios kind of got tied up in the API community.
Yes, it did.
And the web development community kind of lost touch with what the web architecture was. The web was just kind of this VM / janky UI markup, UI markup language that lived almost by accident on everyone's computer, rather than an innovative new network architecture, which is what, you know, originally it was intended to be. So, I don't blame people for, I do blame a little bit the Facebook and Google people, I'm sorry to say, just because I feel like if anyone had the ability to communicate the original web architecture well to the broader development community, it was those companies. And I don't see a lot of that. But Fielding's better here somewhere, his thesis, you know, his PhD thesis that outlined the web architecture is pretty impenetrable. It's not easy reading. So
yeah, and even the O'Reilly books that are meant to be a gloss on that, they're quite impenetrable too.
I often, early on, I would go into REST and Hadios in these talks very early, and I could just see the eyes glazing over, like, what is this guy talking about? Yeah. All right. We'll focus on the practical stuff first, and then maybe we'll talk a little bit more theoretically.
So on that, I wanted to ask about, so when I was learning the web, I remember being like, why do I need all this JavaScript? And it sounds like I've heard you say, you know, the W3C kind of basically stopped with HTML, which is kind of true. I mean, it was created and then they stopped it post with forms, and yet there was all this other information there. So I guess my question is, had anyone else tried to tap into these things? Because it seems like in hindsight, it was just sitting there and everyone just hopped on the JavaScript train and didn't take a solid look at it.
Yeah, I agree. It makes me wonder at times. In Zoolander, there's that line where he says, am I the only one who notices this?
Yeah, am I taking crazy pills?
Crazy pills. And when the more JavaScript I saw, the more I was like, man, what about hypertext? I don't know what to say other than I'm glad that I was able to to work on this, and it seems like it's working out pretty well. I think a lot of people, when they see it, they're like, oh yeah, that seems sane. And so there is something there. I tried to open an issue on the discussion forums for HTML for like the W3C. I don't know what it was. Someone sent me a link. Said, these people do browser stuff. And so I tried to open up a discussion there about extending HTML as a hypertext, but it didn't go particularly well. And I understand that, you know, this random guy's saying, hey, we should think about HTML as a extending it as a hypertext, and they're like, cool, who are you?
The way you get it in is like with the image tag. The image tag, right, they just implemented it, everyone went with it, and then all of a sudden they said, well, we better standardize it. So if you can just keep pushing, you get it.
Yeah, I think I'm not going to, I doubt I'm going to work on Chrome anytime soon.
Fair enough.
And, I'm more than okay with that. But yeah, you know, there is kind of a weird, like, wow, why didn't we just do this?
Yeah, I mean.
I mean, Intercooler's old. It was 2013, so it's been around a while. But it's, you know, it can be hard to sell. I'm just one guy. We've got a small but, you know, good little community around HTMX and Intercooler. But, you know, there's a lot of momentum. And JavaScript, say what we will about it, you can do everything you need to with it. And so, you know, I don't know. You just, if you're not convinced, if the hypertext architecture doesn't speak to you, then, you know, I can see why you might be more inclined to look at a JavaScript solution for things.
Okay, well, just from a Django point of view, like for you know, decade and more, we've been building APIs with Django REST framework, and you know, the clients have been coming and hitting that, and the poor Django templating language has been sat there all the time. People use it for a bit, but oh, you know, I've got to do it in front. But actually, you know, having picked up HTMX and started implementing, it's like, no, I can just create my HTML template. I can send the server. I don't even actually need a DRF view, a REST framework view. I can just do it, and then all of a sudden, I think, right, I need a CRUD for a related object that is triggered by this dropdown. I just create the create view, the update view, the retrieve view for that. And it's all really vanilla Django, like the most basic Django in the world, but it's coming to the browser really smooth in page, quick. And, you know, I go and do the Lighthouse, the audit thing that you've got in Chrome for the speeds. And it's lightning, you know, it's like, green.
And you can cache it pretty easily, too.
Yep.
Yeah, that's one really great thing about HTMX. That's exactly right. So you can rely on old and very proven server-side technologies. And in fact, as you're probably noticing, the encoding difference between HTML and JSON is almost nil.
Like, in terms of size,
the browser size, it barely notices it, and it can often feel faster because you don't have a lot of JavaScript living between the HTML and the actual DOM itself. So you know, I think one of the great things about HTMX is that it brings these tools that are very mature, and we have a lot of experience with. At least some of the older web developers have a lot of experience with caching. You know, you brought up caching, and that's a good example. Like a well cached web app can be very, very fast, and that can be hard to do if you're fronting an arbitrary query API in JSON, right? Like caching that can be very difficult. But if it's just an endpoint with a GET, you know, you can cache that, and you can use whatever, you know, mature caching technology you like to make that much, much faster. And that does bring up something that I think is worth mentioning about when you mentioned building JSON APIs in Django. Your web apps tend to be kind of needly. Like, they tend to have very specific needs. Like, you have to tune a query to make a particular UI work quickly.
Yeah.
Right? You've got to do joins or group bys or whatever it is on your back end. You have something very specific for a particular UI to make it work correctly. And that's in tension with a more general JSON API. When you give out a JSON API to the wider world, if you're, you know, going that direction, those tend to need to be very general. And so you need to have a more generalized API. And the reason why we have technologies, I always want to say jQuery, but what's the Facebook query?
GraphQL.
Standard GraphQL, thank you. I always want to say jQuery, but
we can call it that. We can call it that.
The reason why GraphQL is becoming so popular is because if you try to build an API without a powerful expressive query language like that in JSON, your front end developers are going to ask for like 1,000 different endpoints for all their little needs in the app. And so one of the really nice things about using something like HTMX is that those needs get moved back to the back end where they have SQL, and they can do whatever damn fool thing they want to do against the database, right? And then, you know, maybe you need to tune the database with indexes and all that sort of stuff. But that's an achievable engineering goal versus this more generalized JSON front end API. So I think those are two separate use cases. They have two different technical requirements. And you would see this about, you know, before jQuery slash GraphQL came out, you would have API developers that were in despair because they were constant, you know, you'd be on version 35 of your API before you even shipped 1.0 of your web app, because there's so much churn and just small little changes to make your UI work properly.
And this is awesome, actually, because I've worked on teams where I've been on the back end of that conversation. And it's like, you know, twice weekly meetings on, you know, we need this endpoint, it's got to have these fields. And it just, the feedback cycle there is just so painful and slow and difficult that you come in here with us and you write the endpoint and you know, then there won't be the problem. Right. And
yeah,
it's like we've talked about from episode one of the podcast, we've talked about, is Django a back end or a front end thing? And actually it's a front end thing. And it certainly is if you're, you know, serving HTML and then using something like HTMX to get your interaction on the browser, is that you can write the view, serve the templates, and you're the front end. You're creating it.
Yep, exactly. And that's the architecture of the web too. that's actually how it's supposed to work. Believe it or not, I know. Everyone uses JSON now, but it's not actually JSON isn't a hypertext, guys.
But then it's easy enough to add, oh, we do want a JSON representation of this data for some other use case. Well, fine, you can add that. But if it doesn't have to be your sort of core starting point, it just smooths the development process so much.
Yeah, exactly. And so I agree 100% with that. You should have a JSON API probably, and it should be public, and it should be rate limited, and it should have all these sort of, you know, that's for automation purposes, that's great. But that's not the web. That's probably not, for most applications anyways, not what your web app should be talking to.
Okay.
So can I ask about some of the limitations? Because, I mean, we're both fanboys.
Yeah.
Adam Johnson, a whole bunch of people I really respect are huge fanboys. But there are some limitations. I mean, so maybe we could just talk about this. So an easy one is just maturity of the ecosystem, right? Like in terms of...
Yeah.
So maybe we could start with that. Like, where is that at? And do you see a path for people to add things on? I mean, because you have fantastic documentation on your site, by the way. I love that examples page where you just go, boom, here it is. Like, can it do it? It's just like right there. But you can't do everything.
Yeah. Right. It's a problem. There's some people who contribute, but it is really, it's a one-man show to a large extent. I'm just a dude who lives in Montana, so not Google, not Facebook. I don't have the resources that they have. And with Intercooler, I don't want to say I gave up, but with both of these libraries, they're finished. I think I got the API reasonably correct and the implementation is probably good enough. So I'm not planning on changing them a whole bunch. Nobody ever got fired for using React. I understand that dynamic. There's only so much that I can do as a small, you know, software shop. I think Intercooler, to an extent, since it's been around for so long, it's got 4,000 some odd stars on GitHub. So it's a, you know, it's a medium-sized JavaScript library, relatively mature. HTMX is based on it. HTMX definitely is maturing. It's not as mature, and it's still maturing a little bit. But you know, I would say if you're a maybe a more senior developer and you have some pull in your organization and you really like this style of development, the Discord is active. As long as you're not trying to do anything too crazy, you're going to probably get the help that you need. But I don't want to present it as that there's no risk. It's not, you're not going to be able to hire an HTMX consulting firm to come in and help you. But, you know, I'll help you if you jump on HTMX General.
Yeah.
On Discord.
Well, not yet.
So,
well, there is.
So there's the, yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, so Adam Johnson, again, has this Django HTMX package, which bundles up a lot of things. I was just sort of wondering if you could clone yourself a bunch of times, what would you work on to expand the ecosystem as opposed to working on the backbone?
You know, that's a good question. I would need to think more about that. I think just advocating, maybe trying to explain. I've just had so little success trying to explain the web model to people, just putting some time in and trying to think about what the best way to reach people is. And then honestly, you know, I'm allergic to social media, but I'm on Twitter because I don't know what else to do. I tried Reddit for a while. I just couldn't take the trolls. So it was too emotionally difficult for me to deal with. I think, you know, a lot of stuff that sort of outside development, which I'm just not great at, unfortunately. So for me, I'll just probably keep grinding along on this and coming on podcasts, and you know, we'll see what happens. But I've been really happy with as much uptake as it's gotten, especially with the Django community finding it, because Django has just been so underserved traditionally by the front end libraries that are out there, and this dovetails really well with it. So you know, that's my hope. But as far as technically, like if I clone myself and have more engineers, I'd probably just write more tests.
Can I ask what you use for testing? I haven't dug in and seen, but I'm always trying to choose a JavaScript test framework, and I never know which one to go for. Is it Jest or is it this? Or is it that?
Chai.js. Chai and Mocha.
Okay, fine. Chai and Mocha.
But I just picked whatever the pot mode. I mean, this is why people don't use HTMX, right? I just picked the most popular ones out there at the time I started the project.
Yeah, because it's what is the Cypress now? I think is the hotness.
Is that the new cool one? I used to use a different one that was more browser friendly. Yeah, one of the problems I have in writing a lot of JavaScript is that I try and make everything very browser centric. And the JavaScript world has moved away from that, more towards like this mixed mode or node oriented world. And so it's gotten harder and harder to do browser testing, which is for all my stuff, I just want to do browser testing. So it wasn't a great experience compared to what I was using previously, but that one had apparently died.
Okay.
Can I ask, so in terms of a limit though, I mean, if you were going to build Gmail or, you know, something super dynamic, do you feel like there's a possibility that HTMX could eventually do that? Or like, where is that cutoff? Because there is still, you know, a cutoff somewhere.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I think Gmail should be built in something like HTMX. There's no reason for it to be, right? Like that's insane.
I don't know, Google Maps. I don't know what a good example is of something.
Google Maps for this. So there you go. Google Maps is definitely over the line. If the more client-side state is required for an app, you know, just so like a 3D game or, you know, even a 2D game, this is just not something that's going to be done well in HTML.
So Flight Simulator, they got the whole world digitized.
Right. But Google Maps is a good example of something that wouldn't be done well. And on the other hand, the settings page in Google Maps would be probably something that could be done very well in HTML.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? You always have to like click the save button at the bottom, and I forget that every single time. I flip the switch and for keyboard shortcuts, and then it's like, oh, I didn't. It's so ridiculous.
So that's the sort of stuff where, you know, HTMX is lightweight enough that you can use it for parts of your app, And so there are parts where it probably makes a lot of sense, and then there are parts where it doesn't make a lot of sense. And not just in the more complex world, right? There may be parts of your app that just the very old simple click on links and submit forms works fine for that part, and you don't need to add HTMX. You don't get much by adding HTMX to it. And so just leave it that way, and that simplicity is its own reward. But maybe in some parts of your app, you want to do something like active search, right? Whereas you type, the results filter down based on some server-side filter. And so, okay, then just add a few HTMX attributes just there and implement it just for that spot. And so I think it goes both ways. HTMX can be too complex for some things, you know, proof of concept before you're really into something. And then it can be too simple for other stuff. Like, you're not going to obviously... in the main, write a video chat system.
Yeah.
Or something. Well, like, but that, you can do WebSocket stuff, right? Like, that's... sorry if I interrupted you, yeah, Carlton. Like, you can, I feel like WebSockets is something that's there but not being really used in the same way HTTP2. It's sort of like sitting there, but...
Yeah, there's WebSockets and also server-sent events support in HTMX. I do have to admit those are both much more raw than the AJAX support. And so... I would say more speculative, but they're there. And you know, it's a hopefully reasonable approach from as far as a declarative HTML centric, way of using those technologies goes. But it's definitely a newer area of web development, and it's harder to be sure that we got it right.
I think it's interesting with both. I mean, service sent events is when you just need to receive a stream of, you know, asynchronous events from the server. You don't need to send any data back, so they're perfect. You can open a long request, you just don't close it, and you just send a new event when one's ready. But quite often you don't need that. Like, you don't even need that to leave that connection open and poll, whereas you can just make an AJAX request and yeah, you get it back. And then WebSockets, that one where you're sending two directional traffic, well, quite often you don't need that, it turns out. So
Yeah, I know. I feel like you can do quite... I've done quite a bit with just good old AJAX and maybe some polling. There's a way to poll in HTMX that makes it pretty easy. And you can accomplish quite a bit. You'd be surprised.
Okay, so
I was just going to ask about HyperScript, Carlton, because I know you... Let me ask the question.
Well, because this leads into HyperScript. So it's a more elegant way
to do it. Okay, you go
Carson, I've been using, so you talked about state, client-side state and maintaining state, and like for rich things I've been using Elm for a while, but much closer to the HTML stuff I've been using Alpine.js, because I saw it on I think it was the Tailwind people, they were like, if you would be using jQuery you should be using Alpine. That was kind of how they described it, and I was like, okay, I'll give Alpine a go. And it's the same sort of thing. You just define a few attributes and, you know, it creates a component, and you can save an object there, and that object can have methods, and it's just nice, really quite small. And they say it's like Vue, but I wouldn't know, having not really looked at Vue. And that's great for, you know, when I want to maintain that bit of state. But you've got this other thing which I'm almost in fear of trying. It's called HyperScript, right? And it's so fresh and new, and it looks amazing. I'm just terrified of what is it, what's going on there, and why is it... How?
You're right to be terrified. that is the appropriate response. So, what is HyperTalk? We talked about how HTMX came out of Intercooler, and it was sort of a cleanup of Intercooler. A lot of stuff that I learned and while working on Intercooler, and things that I wanted to improve about it. And one of the things that was in Intercooler that is not in HTMX was something called... the attribute was IC action, so IC dash action. And that was a little way to do some client-side scripting, mainly with jQuery stuff. But it had this kind of funny syntax, and it lets you do to insert weights. Like, you could put a weight 300 milliseconds or whatever in the middle of it. And it was a really simple programming language. I mean, I didn't admit it at the time, but it was a really simple programming language. And so when I created HTMX, I looked at that attribute and was like, you know, this needs a better treatment. This needs a real... I'm a programming language person. I worked on a programming language called Gosu for a long time, which is an obscure JVM programming language. I just looked at that and said, you know what, if I'm going to do that, I need to do it right. This is too janky because, you know, Alpine.js exists. And so if you just want to put a little bit of JavaScript in the DOM, which will remind me, there's a concept I want to talk about around that. You know, you can use something like Alpine. And you know, like I said, I'm a programming languages person, and it's always dangerous when a programming languages person sees a problem like this.
A new language.
I decided, yeah, exactly. And so I decided, okay, well, what this really is this is a programming language that is responding to events. And so I reached back into my memory, deep into my memory banks, and I remembered a scripting language called HyperTalk. And HyperTalk was a scripting language that was a part of the HyperCard development environment on the Mac a long, long time
ago. This is Myst, right? This is what Myst used.
Yeah, Myst was written in HyperTalk. One of the really unique things about HyperTalk is that it had event handlers baked into the language. You didn't call, you know, something.addEventHandler. You just said on click, do this stuff. And I thought to myself, well, that sounds like exactly what I need. HyperTalk, most people haven't heard of it, but some people have experience with AppleTalk, and that experience is not good in general. And I appreciate that, but both AppleTalk and HyperScript are based on HyperTalk. And so basically what I'm doing with this programming language is trying to create a purely front-end oriented scripting language and a true scripting language that allows you to do things that you would do normally, for me anyways, in jQuery. You might use vanilla.js, but it's still pretty ugly compared to a lot of the jQuery stuff. That's what it boils down to. There's some interesting characteristics about the language that I'm sure we'll talk about. But at a high level, it's a front-end scripting language. It's designed to make it easy to handle events and then do simple things like adding classes to other elements.
Because my sort of gloss on jQuery was always select a thing, do a change it, you know, select something and then, you know, add a class or animate it or remove it from the DOM or,
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think HyperScript is intended as a modern replacement for jQuery. If you were to ask me, you know, what are you targeting? It's trying to be a modern replacement for jQuery. Maybe a slightly insane replacement for jQuery.
Can I just add? So currently, you're a college professor teaching compilers classes, right? Just in terms of, that's not like you're coming in. When I came in, I taught like a JavaScript web class, and it was like, yeah, do the fluffy stuff. They're just bringing you into, you know, the depths of a CS undergrad degree. So anyways, I saw that and I was like, man, that's legit. I feel like that's where philosophically I'll probably end up in 20 years is also trying to do, you know, write a new language to solve all my problems, but I'm nowhere near there.
Yeah, it's actually, believe it or not, creating a programming language is easier than it sounds. If you learn recursive descent parsing, recursive descent parsing isn't taught in academia. I teach it because I don't like the way people teach parser generators instead, which is it's much better for producing papers in academia. But I think it's much worse as far as learning how programming languages actually work. And so, it's unfortunate because I think creating a programming language is a mystery for a lot of people, and it doesn't need to be. The parser is actually easier than the tokenizer in many situations. Like breaking the string up into tokens can actually be, like the tokenizer in HyperScript is totally insane because of some of the syntactic stuff that we support. And I should mention HyperScript is going to strike many people as strange because it's more of a natural language. So you would write something like on mouse enter toggle dot visible on hash help until mouse leave. And so it's got this English syntax to it that's can be a little jarring. It's very easy to read, but can be a little jarring.
That's one of the things that terrifies me, because I spent a long time with AppleScript, like trying to automate my Mac to do something or other with its supposedly English syntax. And I'm just like,
Yeah. No, I know. And HyperScript, again, for me, is like, that's my fun project. I don't expect it to be too widely adopted. But there's some cool stuff in it. One aspect that's cool that I kind of alluded to earlier is that you embed it directly in your HTML. And so, like, as with Alpine and as with Tailwind CSS, you put everything into the HTML. It's HTML-centric in that sense. And what that gives you is that when you're curious as to what a button or whatever is doing, you can look at that button and see everything that it's doing there in the HTML. And that is in contrast with the jQuery approach of adding, you know, over in some other JavaScript file, you would add a handler, you know, kind of dynamically. And so I'm trying to popularize this terminology of locality of behavior.
Yeah, you've got a great post on that.
For this mode, right, where you're localizing all of the behavior of a particular code unit, in this case a button in an HTML file, on that button, so that you don't have to go search around in 15 different files to figure out what that button does and why it looks like it looks like. So HTMX also has this characteristic where you can just look at the input and see, oh, it's posting to that and then doing something with the results. And so I'm trying to, again, popularize this notion of locality of behavior to explain the popularity of libraries like Tailwinds. Obviously, Tailwinds is the most successful, but also Alpine, HTMX, and maybe at some point HyperScript.
Yeah, I think the thing that comes up with there on in Django is we have these things called class-based views where, you know, your view is like the thing that turns an HTML request into an HTML response. It's the fundamental handler of the framework. Right. And we have these class-based views, which are great and they're powerful and they, you know, let you define standard stuff very simply, but they have this kind of awkward hierarchy. There's too many classes and too many mix-ins. And if you, there's this whole website devoted to making the class hierarchy browsable so that you can navigate the class-based views. And it's like, that's the problem, is that you've got five files open in the editor. You can't, but by the time you get to the fifth one and go, oh, that's where it comes from, you can't remember what you were looking for when you started this little search. And to have everything in the screen in front of you is just, it's just so important. So empowering.
Yeah, Richard Gabriel, who's a famous Lisp developer, if I'm remembering correctly. Yeah, he wrote the "Worse is Better" paper. I don't know if you've ever read that, but that's a pretty good CS paper to read. Yeah, "Worse is Better." That's about why Unix beat Lisp. So he was a Lisp guy trying to explain why the Unix and C world beat Lisp. But he has a quote that I like a lot that says, "The primary feature for easy maintenance is locality. Locality is the characteristic of source code that enables a programmer to understand that source by looking at only a small portion of it." And so I include that as the sort of lead-off quote in my essay on the htmx.org website about locality of behavior. And I think that captures that idea very well. Like if you want to be able to maintain and understand code, you have to be able to sort of see it all in one spot. The more places you have to go to understand why, how something works, the harder to maintain that code you're going to find it.
Do you see a potential, is there a potential downside to putting so much just in HTML, both with HTMX and these other projects? I mean, I don't see it, but I feel like there must be, you know, there must be some downside or potential downside.
Yeah. I mean, it can be overwhelming if you try to do too much, right? You still need to factor things properly, but to me you want to pick the right axis to factor on, and so pulling something out to a component might be appropriate, but then looking at that component should be understandable just by looking at wherever that component happens to be defined. So you still need to factor properly. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, there comes a point, like, we have extract method for a reason, right? Like there's going to come a point where there's just too much code in line and it's time to pull stuff out to a method. And that's okay, because you can see, okay, this calls that method, and I can, hopefully, if my editor is powerful enough, I can control click on that and jump over and look at the definition. And it's got a good name, and I can live at that level of abstraction and still understand what's going on here. hopefully the method isn't named Do It or something like that, right? So there's a danger. Yeah, do it too. do it again. In my mind, that's just proper software engineering. And I think that we've fallen into this idea of separation of concerns a little too, by default, just because that's the way the web was set up, almost by default. And, you know, Tailwinds, I think, is the most successful going against that grain. You know, the concerns are not separated at all if you're using Tailwinds. And that, to me, when I first saw it, my shoulders tensed up and it just felt wrong. But it's quite popular and it's proven to be a very successful way to build web.
It really grows on you.
So. Yeah, my first couple of hours with Tailwind was just like, well, I can't do this. No, I refuse. No. And after a little while, it's like, hang on, this is quite fun. And then, you know, and you create reusable bits.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that you still need to be a software engineer. But I think you can let go a little bit of separation of concerns for its own sake. And maybe let go of don't repeat yourself for its own sake. Maybe it's okay to repeat some stuff a little bit, if that makes it clearer what's going on.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely. There's times where you might have three lines in a view that strictly it's boilerplate, but it's much better there because it's visible forever than it is abstracted some hook on some superclass, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and that's actually, even just with the generic class-based views in Django, someone brought to my attention, they were asking a question, they're like, where is the success URL on, was it update and delete? And it's like, well, it's actually implicitly goes to get absolute URL in your models. So it would definitely be clearer to put that in there, but it's repeating yourself, so that's attention. So okay. I would say in that case, maybe, you know, so yeah, it depends. So we always try to avoid that, saying that in our podcast, but it depends. There is a trade-off.
There's a trade-off, and there's no math equation you can use here to figure out what the right thing is, right? That's unfortunate. It's just what feels right.
Well, I wanted to ask you about one more thing about HyperScript. I've seen you talking about it on Twitter or a couple of blog posts, but I haven't had the chance to dig in. You said something that HyperScript is something like async transparent, or that might not have been the exact phrase.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. So HyperScript, it's like I said, it's a little bit of a meme language. Whether or not it's used very much in reality isn't. I mean, obviously, I want people to use it, but it's definitely very speculative. But one of the interesting aspects of it is as you said, it's what's called async transparent. And what that means is that in HyperScript, if you do an asynchronous operation, for example, there's you can say wait 3 seconds. You can just, that's valid HyperScript. So on click, do something, and then wait 3 seconds, and then do something else. Add or remove that class from whatever. You can write that in HyperScript linearly. So you just write, you know, do action one, wait 3 seconds, do action two. And the HyperScript runtime will wrap all of that, the execution environment wraps all that up and makes it such that you don't need to deal with callbacks. In JavaScript, to do that, you would use a set timeout and a callback, right? If you were getting really fancy and using fetch or something like that, you might use a wait and, you know, an async tag on your function, and then await a fetch, right? And in HyperScript, you don't need to do any of that. The HyperScript runtime is responsible for if any expression within the runtime produces a promise, which is the JavaScript API for asynchronous behavior, like the low-level API for it, it will basically await that promise resolving before it continues. And that happens at the expression level so that you can write HyperScript basically without worrying about
asynchronous behavior. Did I have to await this? Yeah.
You can just put a fetch. You can put a fetch right in the middle of a function and just keep writing the function the normal linear way. Without having to do an await or, you know, make the function asynchronous, so on and so forth. And so it really takes away all that. Not all of it. You can't take away all of it. But in normal day-to-day programming, it would take away the vast majority of explicit asynchronous code. And that came out of this idea that I, when I'm, you know, with HyperScript, I'm trying to improve the scripting infrastructure of the web. And your normal front-end script, like script writer, shouldn't have to worry about asynchronous stuff. That's just too low level. You just want to issue a request and then take the results and put it into something or whatever it is that you want to do. That's what asynchronous transparency is. The removing the need to worry about whether or not a particular operation is synchronous or asynchronous. You can just write code in the normal linear way, and then the HyperScript runtime works it all out. And I would say technically that's the most interesting aspect of the language. As far as, you know, programming languages go, I think that's fairly unique. The runtime is not fast. I would not write a Bitcoin miner in it, but it does make front-end scripting quite nice if you have to deal with any asynchronous operations. And there's more than you might think. For example, animations like CSS transitions, those are asynchronous, right? Like if you add a class to something or you set a particular property on a length property or an opacity property, the transition that occurs is asynchronous. You actually have to listen for events in order to do that right if you want to wait until it completes to go and do something. And so HyperScript has a bunch of infrastructure to make all that work. And it does allow for some really interesting aspects to it. For example, the loop construct in HyperScript can wait for an event. And so you can have a for loop, effectively it's repeat, but you can have a for loop that waits until an event occurs for the loop to terminate. And there's a good example on the website where there's a button, you click one button and it makes another button start throbbing. And then you click the button again and the button will stop throbbing. But rather than immediately stopping the throb, it'll actually complete the loop and then stop. And so you get a nice smooth animation completion because the loop isn't, you're not removing a class or canceling something. Right, you're just sending an event to this other button, and then the loop will complete its animation loop and then come back and check, oh, okay, I've received the event, so now I can finish. So you can have a nice smooth finish to your animation. So pretty speculative stuff. Very, I don't want to say advanced, but
pretty cool unique. if you experienced these issues at all, or that's super cool.
Yeah, it's an interesting technology. Again, much more speculative than HTMX. I highly recommend HTMX to most web developers. HyperScript, you do have to be a little bit of a lunatic to try at this point, anyways.
I was going to ask, how on the scale of 1 to 10, how advisable is it? Like, you're lunatic, right? So no, that's fine. That's clear.
It works.
So I have one more question about the general ecosystem for my own work. So I've been working with HTMX, I've been working with Alpine, I've been, Tailwind, I've been using a lot more. But looking at then the borderland where it's like, oh, should I do this in one? Should I do this in the other? And then I'm thinking about interactivity, and I don't have an answer there because I'm still exploring and I'm seeing where the APIs slot together and where they don't. And, what's your feeling on the interop in these kind of sprinkles approach libraries?
I think HTMX and Alpine are a solid combination, because Alpine gives you sort of 80 to 90% of what Vue gives you, plus the jQuery aspect of, you get that locality of behavior that you want, the jQuery doesn't really give you, but you can do your front end scripting in a sane world. So I think HTMX and Alpine pair really well together, I would recommend people use HTMX for driving server interactions, and then Alpine when you need a little bit more client-side interactivity. Both of those libraries are nice in that they can be incremental, so you can start with a basic web app that just is the normal, Django 1.0 version of the web app, and then add these behaviors as, where they add the most value. Like one important concept in software development is a complexity budget. Where do you want to spend your complexity budget on your app? And the settings page probably shouldn't have any of your complexity budget in it. And if you use React or something like that, you're going to be surprised how much of your complexity budget ends up being dumped into these, you know, relatively simple web pages. I think that's if sort of coming at it from a pragmatic standpoint, particularly if you have a technology like Django that's already there and works and has standard patterns, I would try and think about it very incrementally. And there's going to be spots where you need more front end. And for those Alpine or, if you're crazy, maybe give HyperScript a try, or jQuery, the fine library for that stuff. And then the more you move towards sort of server interactions, then okay. I think HTML starts
but joking,
to make more sense as well.
Joking aside, on that point, like HyperScript isn't big, right? So I could add it for one little page, and I could use it for one little bit, and I could try that out, and that wouldn't commit me in any great way.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. Again, I think one of the strengths of Alpine and HTMX and HyperScript to an extent is that they're incremental. They don't require you to buy into a huge ecosystem to get the first thing done. You know, with HTMX in any event, you can add three attributes to your web app and have an active search filter on some important page in your web app that adds a huge amount of value for your end users. And all you've done is included a 10K library and put in, three or four attributes into your HTML. So you're not having to rewrite the world in order to get what you want to have happen.
That's very cool. I guess one thing I wanted to add is on the, Google, Facebook, and their cultures thing. I've seen a bunch of interviews with the people who created these projects within those companies, and I'm certainly guilty of saying, well, it's Google and Facebook, they can do anything. But most of those creators, certainly of React, would say they built it to solve a Facebook-specific need, and they had to fight every step of the way to open source it, that Facebook itself was always kind of against it, so that it's almost a little minor miracle that it even comes out, and then they get the added, I don't feel sorry for them, but everyone's like, hey, you're the XYZ company, why doesn't it do all these things? When they're saying, it's a miracle we even put this out there. So it's sort of a cost of doing it within those companies. Though, of course, as you said, when it comes from those companies, it's going to get all this momentum and push. But it's not as if Mark Zuckerberg is saying we need to promote React, I don't think.
Yeah, that's true. And there's so much randomness in the world, it's just, it makes sense. And then in one spot, and then someone picks it up. And one thing you can look back on historically is picking up, and maybe this will let me nerd out a little bit, but the idea of REST and Hadios in the API community, right? Because we started, REST and Hadios was a description of the web. It was a description of this hypertext-based system where the networking infrastructure behaved in a new way. It didn't behave the way old thick clients did. It was a new architecture where hypertext was being exchanged. And when that proved not to, the UX issues around that became obvious, people started doing AJAX, and AJAX started off as XML, and they took the language from that original model, from Willie Fielding's thesis of REST and Hadios, and they tried to use it in the API world. And now when people hear REST and Hadios, they think APIs. And it really doesn't apply very well in that world, in my opinion. Because especially once you get a JSON, you don't have a hypertext. And so all of the infrastructure, all of the network infrastructure that made a lot of sense when we were describing this hypertext system that the original web was, it kind of bled into this. It just stopped making sense, and particularly in JSON. It's almost in my mind kind of cargo culty. But unfortunately, none of the big software companies out there that could explain this do so. I mean, it's not in their interest, and it's not this is a little nerdy. And I was always annoyed by the guys that were like, "Well, your API isn't RESTful," So I get it. Like, how many times in the early 2000s were we on message boards being you know, oh, this isn't the third level of whatever. Yeah,
we have that in Python with it. Pythonic. It's not Pythonic. Right? It's like, oh, really? It's that day, is it?
Yeah, exactly. But you know, it's funny how this stuff works out. So you know, people hate EOS without even understanding really what it is at this point. And you know, if you're using a JSON API, yeah, of course you hate it because it's not a hypertext. So hypertext can't be the engine of application state, or it's going to be real hard to make it the engine of application state if you're going down that road. So hopefully, you know, these things do appear to go in cycles, and so hopefully we can bring people back to this original model for the web. I think the examples, you know, you pointed out the examples, and I think that's probably the best move I've made was creating that examples page. I need to do that for HyperScript as well. That just shows here's what you can accomplish with a little bit of hypertext, with a little bit of an extension to hypertext, and that speaks to people a lot more than me sitting around, you know, explaining why they're wrong about the web. Oh. I do like doing that sometimes. I really like to give that talk at Google.
Well, you should come to a Django con and give it there.
Like, that would be funny. That'd be fine.
Speaking of which, I mean, there are a few people giving talks at the DjangoCon that's just coming up on HTMX, and so we'll put those talks will be before this show comes out, so we'll put the links for those in the show notes as well, because you've really struck a chord in the Django community.
And I'm very excited to, you know, it's just like I never would have expected it. I've probably written 100 lines of Python in my life. If I do start another project, I'm going to take a hard look at Django, though, just because the community is obviously, you know, Python has just grown leaps and bounds. I think even JavaScript has kind of been eclipsed by Python at this point. I wouldn't have expected this, and that's kind of the way life goes. I wouldn't have expected to rewrite it Intercooler.js either, but then they shut everything down.
Yeah, it's good that you managed to make use of the confinement time.
Yeah. Kept me sane for that first couple of weeks. That was pretty crazy. So.
Thank you so much for taking the time and agreeing to come on our Django podcast to talk about this. As we said, I'm hearing a lot about HTMX in the Django world. So hopefully this podcast opens it up to even more people.
Yeah, and I want to encourage people to, you know, there's an HTMX account on Twitter, which it's just me. Something fancy going on. I try not to be too, I'm a pretty informal person, so I say some pretty silly stuff. The Discord as well, which is you can get on at htmx.org/Discord. If you need help, don't struggle. Stack Overflow is still pretty raw as far as HTMX questions go. Hopefully it's, you know, a lot of it's simple enough that you don't need a ton of help. But if you do need help, the community on the Discord channel is very solid. There's some people that know the library, I should say, very well, and we try and keep it very friendly.
Yeah, so. there's Django has a forum.djangoproject.com official forum that is not as used as it should be, but that a discussion is completely top notch. So I imagine there'll be more HTMX on there as well.
Okay. Is there a way on that forum to listen for HTMX questions? Let me write this down. What's it called?
Forum.djangoproject.com. Yeah, you can. It's what is it? It's not Discord. It's
the Discourse. The other one.
It's Discourse. The other one. But yeah, you create an account and you can. Yeah. I think you can follow stuff and you can see if if things that you've commented on have action. I mean, for example, so one of the posts I have is talking about where to put the logic in Django, and that's 2 years old, and that's had a lot of discussions because it's, you know, sort of the equivalent of where is the state. But I opt into seeing when people comment on that.
Yeah, I'm trying to, on all these platforms, set up alerts for when someone mentions HTMX, just so I can jump in and help if possible.
Was there anything else you wanted to shout out while you've got the, have we covered all the bases?
Well, I've got you here. No, I think, you know, again, just I'm really thankful that people are picking this up and willing to take a look at an older way of doing web development, sort of, I would say, the original way. I want to encourage people to just maybe have a little bit of courage and going against the grain, because I do think that for a lot of web apps, there's a lot of great technologies that are just laying around waiting for web developers to pick up and use that would simplify things dramatically and make both their lives as well as the lives of their users a lot better. So, I'm extremely thankful to you guys for, this is all JavaScript stuff. So thank you for talking to me about it. And I'm very happy that it's proving useful and kind of giving Django some new legs, as far as being a tier one.
It's really
one
exciting
web
times.
Platform.
So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. As ever, we're at DjangoChat.com, chat Django on Twitter, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
See you next time. Bye-bye.
Cheers.